It's 7 p.m. Thursday, and this is All About Wine. With All About Wine's resident wine expert, Ron, Vice President and General Manager of Florida Estates Winery in Land O'Lakes, Florida.
First, we were talking last week about Asian wineries and Asian grapes. We're going to finish up Australia today. That's what we're doing with the France. So we're continuing with France. Basically, what we're trying to do on this program is trying to educate people and trying to make wine less confusing and more friendly. Mike and I were talking about is the possibilities of hooking up with different wineries in different states and finding out what's going on. Sounds like it might be a whole lot of fun.
Holyfield Vineyard and Winery in Basser, Kansas.
Organic Farm on the coast of Maine near Mount Desert Island.
Westport Rivers, Westport, Mass.
Haverhill.com.
The Napa Valley of the Midwest.
RainbornWines.com in Santa Rosa.
Ten Spoon in Montana.
Alba Vineyards.
We're the largest estate vineyard in New Jersey.
Heritage Vineyards and Winery, New Jersey's top-rated winery for 2011.
India Vineyards on Route 93, that's the main highway coming right up the center of New Hampshire out of Massachusetts.
Bebach Winery, we are actually the highest-rated red wines in New Mexico.
Well, Southwest Wine is actually located in Deming, New Mexico.
Well, La Viña is the oldest winery in New Mexico.
Castello di Borghese, the first winery established in Long Island.
Blackhead Lake Winery, and we're located at Crusher Park in Montana.
Mammoth Prairie Winery in Moscow, Idaho.
Brotherhood is America's oldest winery since 1839.
Ithaca, New York, College of Agriculture and Life Sciences, grapesandwine.cal.cornell.edu.
The website is freethegrapes.org.
All right, grab a phone and let's talk about wine tonight. Dial area code 646-727-3235. That's 646-727-3235. All right, let's start the show and let's talk about wine.
Thank you, Buzz people.
Yeah, wow, that's a good group tonight. That's amazing. Yeah. They're all here now because they don't want to get caught in the blizzard that we're going to have Sunday. So
that's right. Yeah,
Another cold front coming in. Here we go.
The state fair. Every time the state fair opens, we can always count on bad weather for 5 or 6 days.
That's right. Oh, did you go and try the donut burger that they have now?
No, I did not. No.
I was going to ask you what kind of – before the show started, I was going to ask you what kind of wine would go good with a donut burger.
Donut? Boy, that's just a taste challenge in the mouth. You've got the sweet donut, then you've got the burger. So, yeah. Wow.
And you've got 6,000-something calories. I forgot how much.
Yeah, I know. It's outrageous. I'll have to get back to you on that. I'm not sure. I'll have to do some research.
You could do a whole – yes. Some, you're going to go down there with a couple of bottles and no, that doesn't work.
Buy a couple of – get enough calories for a whole month just by
– That's right. Yep. That would do it.
It would.
Let me bug out of here real quick, and I'll be back with our first guest.
All right. Hopefully. And I'll stay here and talk to everyone. Thank you all for joining us tonight. If you're live, if you'd like to talk to our guests, 646-727-3235. Or if you're listening to archives, don't call. You won't get through, obviously. Again, thanks for listening live or listening to us on the archives. We appreciate you doing it. It's just we don't have sponsors, so it's nothing to try to impress people. It just makes us feel really good to know that you're out there listening to us. It's really a lot of fun to know that all of you enjoy the program. If you ever have any suggestions, if you ever have any comments, if you have anything that you'd like to talk to me about or would you like me to talk to our guests about in the future or at any time, by all means, get in touch with me. You can get on the Facebook. That's All About Wine BTR. That's Blog Talk Radio. It's on Facebook, All About Wine BTR. Or you can email me. That is allaboutwine101, as in the numbers 101. I paused there because our guest dropped, the call dropped here for some reason. Oh, he's back. It looks like he's going to be coming in on another line. That's even better. Allaboutwine101 @gmail.com if you need to get a hold of us or have any questions or just want to drop a line to us and let us know what you think of the program, allaboutwine101@gmail.com. Our guests tonight, we have a couple of them. Hopefully we have a couple of them. Our first one's on the line, so we're thrilled with that. The second one I didn't confirm because I've had to work and – Well, maybe he's not on the line again. I was just getting ready to bring him on. I'm looking at my my switchboard here, and I'm noticing that the calls are disappearing for some reason. I don't know if it's connections or what's happening, but we are seem to be having a problem here. So I'll wait until Mike gets this good and secured here for us, and then we'll be able to bring our guest on here. Our guest tonight, the first guest tonight, is Don Crank. He is the winemaker, or one of the two winemakers, at Willamette Valley Vineyards. He'll be telling us about the vineyard. He'll be telling us about everything there and what all is going on. I guess he's still with us. I don't know. let me bring him on here. Are you with us?
What time was that supposed to be at, Mike?
Oh, he's not. Mike? Let me put you back with Mike. No, he wasn't with us. I guess they're having a connection problem there or something. So we'll let them go ahead and hash that out off the air before I bring them on. We find out. That's what I get for not confirming my calls. It was my problem today. I've had to work today. We had a situation come up here where I was end up working. I usually have Thursdays off, and I confirm all of our calls and everything. And today I didn't get an opportunity to do it because I was working. And now it seems to be that we're having some problems here connecting. But that's okay. We've done programs in the past with without guests. I suppose we can do another one, even though you may be tuning in to hear the guests. So I apologize about that. I was thinking the other day, and I need to talk to Mike about this, but I was thinking the other day that we've started to get the guests in from the other wineries about, 8-10 states, into the program where we were doing the states, let's see what's going on here. I'm trying to see what's going on. For some reason here, we are having a problem getting our guest in, but that's no problem. I'm sure they'll iron it out off the air, and we can go ahead and take care of it. Don't want to sit here and leave you a whole bunch of dead air, but that always seems to be the case where we get ourselves a bunch of listeners whenever we have problems like this. So we were about 10 states into covering the United States when we decided that we'd start bringing guests on the air, which was a great idea. Actually, Mike was the one that sent out the first email to the wineries, and I started calling and asking them if they wanted to be on. And we started to get quite a few guests on, and as you hear at the beginning of the program, we have ourselves a long list of guests that have came on and informed us of the wineries and their states and all that. Extremely interesting guests. I have absolutely loved it. I've learned so much from these different people and about the wineries around this country and everything. We have missed the first ones, though. We didn't get a chance when we started Alabama. We didn't get a chance to bring some of those listeners or some of those wineries on. And I seriously think we might need to go back and catch those up. We need to go back and talk to those people and bring some of those people on the air. Some fascinating people. There was a gentleman in Alabama who I spent almost 2 hours on the phone when I talked to him about wineries down there. The first winemaker of Alabama, basically, the currently. Old man, he said when he started, he thought he was going to be making wines and selling wines. He ended up being a politician because he has to battle the state of Alabama all the time for what he does and what he's trying to do in the wines and everything. But,
okay.
Oh, you're with us.
Yes. Okay, go ahead.
Don Crank, I see his name up here on the switchboard too, so he's with us. So we'll talk about that later. I was talking about the fact that we need to back up and catch some of our earlier states that we didn't have guests on and see if we can't get some people from those to come on and talk to us about it. So we'll have to talk about that further. Right now, we have Don Crank, who, like I just introduced a little bit earlier, is the winemaker, I guess the co-winemaker, assistant winemaker, at Willamette Valley Vineyards. Don, you with us?
I sure am. Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, thank you for joining us. I have to warn you right at the beginning here. I talked to Matt. Matt Boynton is the one I originally contacted, and he is I asked him to be on. He said, no, we need to get Don on. And I said, well, I'm not going to give him any curves. I'm not going to give him any problems. I'm going to, you know. And Matt says, no. He said, give him all the curves you want. Put him on the spot. I mean, he needs to think about things. So,
sure.
So if we throw anything at you, then blame Matt, not me. well, tell us about Willamette Valley Vineyards.
Well, so Willamette Valley Vineyards is probably the third largest winery in the state of Oregon. We produce around 100,000 cases a year. They're using really nice round figures. You know, sometimes we'll produce more and sometimes we'll produce less. You know, it's still farming after all. We do end up with different yields for different years. But we primarily are growers and producers of Pinot Noir. Makes up the largest part of what we do here, but we also make Pinot Gris and Riesling that are sold all over the country, as well as a small amount of Chardonnay.
Wow. I noticed on the website that you have, what, 5 different Pinots?
Well, that's right. And in fact, in a given year, in terms of all the stuff that goes out to the wine club that, you know, your generally won't be seen by the rest of the country, just that only if you sign up for our wine club, we'll produce almost, 12, 13 different blends of Pinot Noir every single year.
Wow.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, every now and then we'll do a custom crush operation for a grower that really wants to really want someone to make their wine, and but really it's in terms of blends under our brand name. Yeah, I'd say 10 to 13 different blends of Pinot Noir.
Wow, that is amazing. Now, I read something a couple weeks ago while I was doing some research in Oregon, and I noticed that Oregon has a lot of I don't want to say hybrids, but a lot of different types of Pinot Noirs, a lot of different ones that they that different strains or something. I've lost on my word here.
The word you're looking for is clone, I think.
Clone.
Yeah,
thank you.
Pinot Noir is a very mutatable grape, so even when the plants are growing out in the field, you can see some of them change, and really dramatically sometimes you can see where one plant will grow Pinot Noir clusters, and then on the other side they'll be yellow, so they'll be growing Pinot Gris and Pinot Noir on the same plant, and that's just a genetic mutation that happens in the field.
Wow.
So to that end, the Pinot Noir is mutating all the time, and so there are these different clones that happen, and where winemakers throughout time in memoriam have liked certain plants more than others and have selected them and then planted whole vineyards of them. So because of that, you can go to different vineyards in Europe and take the clonal material, take the Pinot Noir out of the ground, or just in terms of just the pruning stuff. You know, you cut off a large part of the plant every year when you prune it. Take those that pruning waste, generally is what it is, and cut them into sticks. Stick them in the ground, and you can grow a row of Pinot Noir, and then you can grow a whole field out of that once it's taken root. So through this way, people have propagated different clones of Pinot Noir, and that allows us a lot of flexibility when it comes to blending time. You know, certain clones do better in dry situations, and if you've got irrigation, you probably want other types of clones. And if you're you have higher altitude sites, or if you're growing Pinot Noir in the valley, you know, you might choose different clones. And then also, you know, your style is really influenced by your clonal selection. So it really is a way to make a lot of different choices and stylistic choices when you're planting a Pinot Noir vineyard, and then even in the cellar when we're blending our Pinot Noir, those 13 different blends, we're very conscious of which clones they are, and you can use different clones to accomplish different things in your blend. So it's that's a really important point you're talking about right there. The clonal selection is a big deal. So.
Well, yeah, that fascinates me, and the fact that I just read that the other day. Now, the Pinot Noir does that, but I've never heard of any other plants. Is it just the Pinot Noir is the only one that decides to do that, or is it subdued in other vines, or what?
Well, it's, you know, there are different clones of a bunch of different varietals. So Cabernet Sauvignon has about 3 really famous clones that are grown in Oregon, and they're probably worldwide many more than that. So all Vitis vinifera, which is the scientific name for our grapevines, all those plants do this mutation, this genetic roll of the dice, and then people throughout time immemorial have capitalized on those and selected for the ones that they thought worked better in different situations. But there's a cult of Pinot Noir in this country and also worldwide, and people are really trying to, and it's also a very difficult grape to work with for a lot of other reasons. So
right.
Perhaps people are more willing to experiment with different clones of Pinot Noir than they would be with Sauvignon Blanc or Cabernet Sauvignon or Syrah, but those clonal differences do exist. It's just, I think they're just more pronounced than Pinot, and you know, Pinot has a lot of multiple personalities to it. You know, there's a lot of different wines out there that are called Pinot Noir, and it's true that they are, but you get a lot of different expression depending on where it's grown, which clones you choose, and then the winemakers, you know, puts his impression on the wines as well. So just a lot of variability with Pinot Noir, maybe more than any other grape varietal.
I have talked to wineries throughout the country. Well, that's what we're doing, working our way through the United States and different ones that have grown grapes and stuff like that. Oregon, and what I've researched and what I just heard from you, is the first one that has ever brought up anything or said anything about the clones and working with the clones. What do most, and I'm not trying to put, well, yes, I am, because Matt told me to put you on the spot. I'm not trying to put you on the spot, though, but what most everyone just sort of ignores the different minute clones that are popping up on the vine and just blends them all together?
Well, no, that's not true. You know, we other wine growing regions are really focused on clones, and it's a big decision that you make whenever you decide to plant a Pinot Noir vineyard, whether you're in the Finger Lakes region of upstate New York, or if you're in the Santa Rita Hills in California. I mean, you know, there are these are very important questions. Now, I think that perhaps older vineyards, you know, that were planted in California before 1950, you say, when they have Pinot Noir grapes, they may not know the exact clones that were chosen back then because it's kind of been lost to the sands of time. But you know, these clones are being planted very widely outside of Oregon, and it's an important part of any wine growing region which clones to choose. Perhaps because we have so many different wineries that are really just so focused on making Pinot Noir, we in Oregon make a bigger deal out of the clonal selection part than other people might. We just have a lot of you know, because there's so many different wineries, there's a lot of winemakers, and then there's a lot of grape growers, and compared to how much actual production we create. So you'll have a lot of opinions. There's a funny joke that goes, if you ask 3 winemakers their opinion, you'll get 4 opinions, because someone will change their mind after they heard the second guy say this, you know. So,
yeah.
You know, that happens a lot. And so I think we're maybe more vocal, and since our whole industry revolves around Pinot Noir, at least in the Willamette Valley, you know, we are, you know, probably we talk a lot more about the clonal differences, but those differences are just as important in California or New York or wherever you're growing Pinot.
Oh, it's okay, great. I never have asked people about that. I've never known really about that, and so great, thank you. That's something interesting that I just again first read about that when we were talking when I was researching Oregon, and I noticed a section on one of the sites that talked about all the clones of the Pinot, and I was amazed. So.
Yeah, well, absolutely. And, you know, and before, say, you know, the 80s, really Oregon only had 2 major clones, and the so-called Pommard clone and the so-called Wadenswil clone. And those were great, and they still formed the backbone of the Oregon wine industry, and we're still planting those, even today. But because Ivory Vineyards South Block, 1978 South Block, won such a prestigious tasting in Paris, actually, amongst really heavy-hitting Pinots from back then in Burgundy, there's been a lot of interest by French growers. In fact, most notably, Maison Joseph Dron purchased land in Oregon and built a winery, and his daughter, Veronique, does the winemaking Domaine Drouin Oregon, DDO. They brought in some more clonal selections that are now widely used in Oregon. They have really silly names like 667 and 777, and so they're not so romantic as the Pommard, But there's also a few other ones that were brought over, through the action of the CEO of my company, Jim Bruneau, and a few others, David Adelsheim, and a few others that are called 113, 114, and 115, and those are pretty widely planted too. So it goes. I mean, even today, there's we were talking about planting a small piece of ground and thinking about the clonal ideas, and there are 600, 800 series clones that are Dijon clones as well that have different properties and are really not very well tried in Oregon. So, it's a long process of experimentation, but we're beginning to figure out what goes where and what's the best clone to plant where, and so we're figuring it out over time. But it really it's making the wine better as time goes along, really, in Oregon.
So you're 16 different types of Pinots. Are they all 16 different clones, or are most of them just blends?
Most of them are blends of in between 2 and 5 different clones of Pinot Noir, I'd say.
Ah, okay. Wow, fascinating. I am fascinated by the Pinot. I'll have to do some more research on it just to satisfy my own questions. So, Willamette Valley, how long has it been there, and how did it get started?
The vineyard was planted in 1983, and it was really just the first 25 acres of it was planted by our founder and CEO, Jim Bruneau, in the town of Turner, Oregon. We're really close to Salem, Oregon, so most people are more familiar with the capital of Oregon, Salem, where we're just a few miles away from the capital here at in Willamette Valley Vineyards. We're in the South Salem Hills, which is not a recognized wine-growing region, but may be one in the future, sub-appellation of the Willamette Valley. The winery was started in a unique way. A lot of folks don't know that we're the only privately held winery in the country, which means we're traded on the NASDAQ under WVVI, but we're not owned by a larger multinational corporation. You yourself or any of your listeners could buy stock in our company and be a partial owner of our company. I myself own stock, and so it's generally you'll see most wineries are. If they are publicly traded, they've been sold long ago or to larger companies or just are in the hands of one, charismatic, generally high-profile owner. But in our case, we're owned by our shareholders. But still, the controlling interest in the company is owned by Jim Bruneau, the founder and CEO. We actually source our fruit from three different main vineyards that we manage wholly ourselves: the estate property around our vineyard, the Anoli Hills site, which is a beautiful site in the Anoli Hills called Elton Vineyards, and that's another 56 acres, and then about 170 up. That's the old Tualatin Estate vineyard that was planted in the 70s, actually 1970, I believe, by Bill Fuller. It's one of those iconic historical vineyards from Oregon. So the story there is we have three wonderful vineyards to choose from and that play off each other. Tualatin's very warm. Elton is kind of in the middle in here. We have a cool wet side at the estate site. But in a warm year, that makes the best wine. So we're really lucky to have those three principal Pinot Noir vineyards to really be able to make the best of our blends each year.
What do you have planned? How many acres of each of your wines you make? Obviously, the Pinot Noir dominates, but what others and how many acres?
Well, so to break it down, and just in terms of acres grown, of the 320 acres that we manage, three quarters of it's Pinot Noir better. So, we're talking about somewhere in the neighborhood of 220 acres of Pinot Noir, and then the rest of it is made up of Pinot Gris and Riesling mostly. But we have a small amount of Muscat, semi-sparkling Muscat. We don't get to export that to different states, but it's sold mostly in Oregon, and that's kind of a fun side project. We make a Moscato d'Asti clone with it, and then we have a couple different what my boss calls winemaker toys. We grow a little bit of this and a little bit of that. I've got Gruner Veltliner and some Pinot Blanc and a few other things that really just they aren't the major upshoot of what we do, but they're really fun. They're really fun wines to produce every year.
Yeah. That sounds interesting. Well, the Pinot Noir being the driving force behind everything there, then.
100%, absolutely. Yeah. It's. I mean, that's the reason this company was started, and that was the first thing that Jim planted. We're currently planting more 23 more acres this year of Pinot Noir. So it is our major focus. That's for sure.
Four vineyards there, four different sites, you're going to have different soils. What type of soils do you find in each of the vineyards?
So Elton and the estate site are volcanic in origin, the so-called Jory series soils. Jory, by the way, is the state soil of Oregon. It's definitely a prevalent soil in Oregon, but at the same time, it's one that grows a lot of the high-end Pinot Noir for Oregon, and that's in contrast to the Willie Kinsey style soils. Jory style soils or series soils are volcanic in origin. They're lava flows that have been rained on for millions of years, and so they're very iron rich and very acidic. This is kind of the opposite of the soil that you'll find in Burgundy. Burgundy soils have a lot of limestone and are very alkaline. And so, the soil itself leaves a certain indelible mark, some people might call that terroir. Or whatever, it's just the impression that the site and the soil and the weather leave on the resultant wine, and just making gross generalizations, you'll find really bright red cherry and dusty cherry types of elements, the aromatic elements, and then and that's to be contrasted with the Willie Kinsey style series soils. Those Willie Kinsey soils are they're non-alluvial sedimentary soils, which means that they're ancient seafloor that have been, elevated out of the sea through volcanic activity. And so they tend to produce Pinot Noirs with a lot of black fruit qualities those are the two major soils in Oregon. But then we also grow on laurelwood soils, which are that same volcanic base soil as the Jory soil, but then are covered with windblown loesses, which are these very fine, well-drained soils that are created by when the time of the glaciers, and there was a lot of blowing dirt in the air that settled on top of the laurelwood soil. So, we have those are the three major soil types that we grow on in Oregon, and you'll find that probably I would say better than 80% of the wine Pinot Noir in Oregon is grown on those three types of soils.
Uh-huh. What fertilization or not fertilizing watering? Do you have to water, or do you get enough rain through the year?
There's a couple of folks that do irrigate all the time, even with mature plants. But here at Willamette, we only irrigate for the first 3 years, just to kind of get the plants a good head start in life. I mean, you can imagine how frail these small plants are in their youth, and so and they're quite expensive. It's $3 or $4 a plant, depending on where you buy them, and they're 1,000 per acre. So you can imagine if you lost an acre of grapes, what it costs there. So yes, we do water them the first 3 years, but then after that, really we have these clay subsoils that hold in moisture, even though we have a long dry growing season. There's plenty of rain in the off season and in winter, and so I think, you know, it's not necessary to irrigate. And in fact, most of Oregon is dry farmed. And to that end, there's a group of people that they're called the Deep Roots Society of Oregon, and they think that irrigation is evil, and as the plants are irrigated, the roots are forced to stay at the surface and not go and break up the hard, you know, jewelry right. boulders and rocks underneath the vineyard, and the less they struggle, the worse wine they make. And so, you know, while we're not psychologically tied to that movement, we mostly do dry farm our Pinot Noir, and only would think about hand irrigating if we had a very, very hot heat spike that happened that was multiple days long to 2 weeks long, where we would actually see the plants devastated by hot spikes. But you know, gosh, I've been making wine in Oregon for now 12 years, and you know, I've only really seen that in two vintages, and only really in 2003 did it threaten our vineyards terribly. So, you know, once a decade, you might have to go get a tank and hand water some stuff, but it's really not enough of a threat to put an irrigation on our vines. So
I see. When do you get bud break? About what time of year?
You know, we've seen it, so it's variable, April to May, and it kind of, you know, you'll get it, you know, fairly early or fairly late, depending on, you know, how early you get the warm weather. You know, you just need a few days in, you know, above 65, and the plants, you know, almost can just, you can almost see them getting ready and then making woolly buds and pushing them. And so, but that factor that I'm saying, the reason that there's such a big spread, or maybe a result of the fact that there's such a big spread in bud break, means that our growing season can vary, you know, quite a bit in terms of its length. And so that really makes a big difference oftentimes in the quality of the Pinot Noir that you produce. The longer the growing season, generally the better, the more physiologically ripe the grapes get. You know, Pinot Noir has very green seeds a lot of times, and the seeds do not lignify or create tannins that are pleasant. Oftentimes they have very green tannins, and so that's one of the reasons we're very, very gentle when we process the Pinot Noir and don't let a lot of the seeds contact the wine. But that's not to say that some years we do have such a long growing season that the actual seeds lignify and turn brown. When that happens, the stems turn brown, and then we're not so worried about being gentle, because we know that the type of tannins that are present in the seeds are good to be in the resultant wine. So as you can see, it's you know, the length of the growing season really has a big effect on how sophisticated the tannic structure of our wines are.
And so your harvest then can vary anywhere from what, the 1st of August to the end of November?
Well, yeah, the earliest I've ever done it is September 15th, and that was in 2006. That was the first day we picked Pinot Noir, earliest we've ever picked Pinot Noir. But, you know, the first day of my pick this year was almost into November. So, you know, that harvest time can swing almost 2 months. So, you know, it's just, you know, I really wish it had a lot more predictable corners. And I think for the large part in California and most of the older, you know, wine growing regions of California, you really can set your calendar by bud break and harvest. But in Oregon, it's a really variable thing. We're a cool climate, and so our cool climate varietals also are very I don't want to say picky, because that's maybe too much anthropomorphizing of them, but it's just that you're not always going to have the perfect growing conditions, and so it's up to the farmers and winemakers to really pay attention to what's happening, understand what kind of growing season they have, and then make the wines and grow the grapes accordingly.
You answered that question there. Do you ship a lot out of state, or do you? You mentioned the wine club, so most of your Pinots are sold through the wine club, and you don't do a lot of out of state shipping. Just everything right there.
Well, you know, I would say that's true for our very high end wine. So We make wines that, like say for the example of the Pinot Noir, we make a Pinot Noir that's around the $20 price point all the way up to $100 price point. So anything around the $50 to $100 price point is sold almost exclusively through our wine club. And you know, these are the best wines that we make every year, the most concentrated and the most new French oak and the most fussy barrel selections and that sort of thing. And that's very much true that most of that's sold directly to consumer. But then we also make, for those lower price point wines around $20 and $30 a bottle, those are sold nationwide. And, in fact, the breakdown there would be somewhere, you know, more than half, probably two-thirds of our wine is sold nationwide, and then a third within the state of Oregon.
Wow.
You know, in bottle shops and, you know, in Oregon you can sell wine in grocery stores as well, so some of it's sold there. So, you know, it's, you know, sometimes we talk about having two sides to our business. We have our high-end production that is sold here at the tasting room and goes to the wine club, and then we have another slightly higher volume side to us, that where you can buy wines in fine bottle shops and places like other retail outlets in other states.
Wow. You're quite diversified on that. Your Chardonnay, a very oaky second fermentation style, or is it un-oaked? Well, how do you do your Chard?
Well, in Oregon, we're a cool climate winemaker, so we really like to have acid-driven wines. So, you know, I think we've never gone all the way through malolactic fermentation with our Chardonnay, or very rarely. Usually it's partial mellow, so there's still a little green acid left in the wines, a green apple snap kind of left in the wines, the Chardonnay. But then it's all done barrel fermented, and then a lot of stirring, which is called the batonnage with the baton. You know, you stir the barrels.
Right.
So that's definitely part of our style. I think we owe more of our paradigm to you know, white Burgundy. We're choosing French barrels, not American barrels. Oftentimes we use very Pinot-like barrels that are all about the sort of the spice and less about the vanilla, cotton candy, and chocolate elements that you would get out of you know, American oak. So you know, we're after acid-driven wines that are food-friendly, and that definitely applies to the Chardonnay. We want it to be different than, you know, that sort of California idea of Chardonnay, poor fruit thrown at a lot of, you know, American oak and that sort of thing. We really want them to not be so flabby and not be cocktail wines that I like is what I call them. It would be rather really food friendly wines. So.
Mm-hmm. And the Riesling is sweet or dry?
Well, you know, I'd call it medium sweet, or sometimes we'll call it off dry. It's 3 grams per liter. 30 grams per liter, 3% residual sugar there, which means that when you drink it, it starts off as like kind of sweet, right? It comes in with all this honey and honeysuckle and really lovely sweet elements. But one thing about Oregon Riesling is that it always has a lot of acid. Titratable acidity is a bit, you know, up to almost 11 sometimes, which is really a lot of acid. So it's kind of like a roller coaster ride on the palate. It comes in very, very sweet, but then almost immediately cleans up with this really nice sort of malic acid that takes you right through the finish. And so, it comes in cloying sweet and ends up very, very, very acid and very clean. So it's really a fun wine to show, because everybody's thinking, you know, that I'm a, you know, Pinot Noir producer, and those are the best wines that I make. And it's true, we make a lot of great Pinot, but oftentimes people will find that the Riesling is despite the idea that they think that all Rieslings are very cloyingly sweet, has enough acid backbone and is at such a reasonable price point that they end up purchasing that for their wine list and not the Pinot, or maybe sometimes they'll take all of them. But it's an awful way, a lot of fun making Riesling. It's one of the best-selling white wines in Oregon, and in years past it's been the best-selling white wine in Oregon made by Oregonians. So we're really proud of the Riesling too, and you know, it's mostly sold only within 100 miles of our front door. So it's one of those wines that really we're just now sort of showing on the national scene, but I've had a lot of great feedback.
With Salem just right down the road, though, within 100 miles, really covers a lot of people. So that You're encompassing a lot there. Do you French oak and oak most everything, or stainless on the Riesling?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, Pinot Gris and Riesling are all stainless steel, although there's a little bit of barrel fermented Pinot Blanc that goes into the Pinot Gris, and a little bit of barrel fermented Pinot Gris. But you know, that's almost 1 or 2% of the overall. So all barrel aged and barrel fermented, in fact, with our Chardonnay and Pinot Noir. But then the Pinot Gris and the Riesling are definitely stainless steel fermented.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned something earlier. You ran over it, but I'm going to ask again about it. You are in the Willamette Valley AVA. You mentioned that you're trying to get another smaller AVA.
Well, that's right. Two of our principal vineyards, the Tualatin Estate Vineyard and then our Estate Vineyard, are in you might call not recognized American viticultural areas. They would be, if we were to succeed, they would be called sub-appellations of the Willamette Valley, just like the Red Hills of Dundee or the Oyola Amity Hills are. The one that where I'm talking to you from right now where our winery would be called the South Salem Hills. And it's the same geological formations that form the Eola Amity Hills as well as the Red Hills of Dundee. That's ancient lava flows that have been eroded by a lot of rain. But then there's also that where our Tualatin Estate property might be called, and the growers around that area would call it the Tualatin River Valley, and and the soils there are very different than they are here.
Oh, okay. So there is enough of a difference that it could be smaller AVAs all over the place around there then.
That's right. Yeah, there's potential for more than the five that are already approved, and I think as time goes along, you might see them. We'll call them emergent AVAs, and I think you'll see that those AVAs emerge over time. The thing is, there's a lot of wineries in the ones that were approved, and the South Salem Hills, as well as in the Tualatin River Valley, there's not as many wineries as there are vineyards. And so I think, a lot of political power rests in the wineries, and the growers oftentimes don't have as much say in what AVAs get approved or don't get approved.
Without a doubt, that really sums it up quite well is what happens on these. And, you know, I like the little small AVAs. You know, when you were talking about just the little vineyards and stuff like that, the little small AVAs really pinpoint the character of the grape much more so than something like, well, I always like to point out the Mississippi Valley AVA, which covers like 300 million acres or something. So the small AVAs bring out characteristics that you don't find in the enormous ones. So saying the Willamette Valley AVA encompasses so much that the variations and everything, it's best that they do get small ones, I think. So, yeah, just, I'm going to, I understand, are busy. You're still at work. We're talking to you in the evening of our Eastern time here, but you still are out there in your Western time zone, so you're still at work. So I am going to let you go, but before you go, give me address, name, phone number, email, website, Facebook, everything for Willamette Valley Vineyards.
Okay, contact information are as follows. So the physical location of the winery is 8800 Enchanted Way, Northeast, and that's in Turner, Oregon. Let's see. So then the telephone number is 503-434-1118. Then you also have the website is Willamette Valley Vineyards, all one word, .com. So that's pretty easy to remember. You got to spell Willamette, which is a Native American word and can be hard to spell. Willamette. So that's the Willamette part, and then Valley Vineyards, all one word. And then you can join our wine club, purchase wine if it can be shipped to your state, all directly from that website. And you know, it's it'd be great for any of your listeners that would like to come out to Oregon and visit the winery facility. We're open 7 days a week from 11 o'clock to 6 o'clock. And you know, and I think we're only closed the 4th of July and Christmas or something. I mean, it's very – or New Year's Day. And those, you know, that besides that, we're open for business, and you can try a startling array of different idiosyncratic Pinot Noirs at our tasting room, as well as some of the small run fun white wines that we make that are discussed here today. So, you know, come one, come all. Please visit us. And, you know, Oregon from spring all the way into fall is a wonderful place to visit, and if you're brave enough to weather the storms that happen in winter, it is also equally fun to visit here in winter. It never gets very very cold. It's always very mild because of our proximity to the Pacific Ocean. So, you know, please look us up and come visit, or at least visit our website.
Thank you very much, Don. We appreciate all that. And you don't really work for the Chamber of Commerce, do you?
No. I certainly don't. But you know, the more people try Pinot Noir, especially our Pinot Noirs, the more they become fans for life. And so I just encourage you to try as many Pinot Noirs as you can. And I think you'll find that a lot of great quality Pinot Noirs are made right here in Oregon.
Thank you very much. Best of luck to you. If we're out there, we will definitely stop by and visit you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Interesting. Now we've got someone else who I am sure is going to be just as interesting. We have a visitor from another winery in the Willamette Valley, Rick Maffitt. I believe I pronounced that right. Rick Maffitt from Mystic Wines. Rick, you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Good. Glad you joined us tonight. Welcome.
Thank you.
Mystic Wines, tell us about it. Mystic
it's a
Valley?
Pardon me?
Is it Mystic Valley?
No, it's Mystic Wines.
Okay.
And it is, so as from Don's place, it's about 30 minutes north.
Oh, really?
North.
That's all? Yeah.
Yeah, we're actually, he's on one side of Salem, and he's on the south side, and I'm on the north side.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So I started the winery back in 1990.
Wow.
The first wines came out in 1992, so actually this is our 20th anniversary this year.
Congratulations.
Yeah, I think. It's like time flies when you're having fun or something like that.
It does.
Or when you've got your nose to the grindstone, however it goes.
Yeah.
But, you know, we started off just making Merlot in Oregon and from southern Oregon. There was so much Pinot Noir, and that's what everybody's known for up here in the north end of the state, that I think, you know, I came up here from Sonoma, and I wanted to do something a little bit different. This was kind of the Wild West, and I had tasted quite a few vintages from southern Oregon, and I knew there were some good grapes up here. And I thought, well, you know, I'll be the guy that doesn't do Pinot Noir. And as it turns out, 20 years later, I not only make Pinot Noir, but that's what I grow, too. you know, it's funny how things change. I guess I saw the light. But I'm kind of unique. Our plan has always been to be small and be local. So try not to do too much out of state. I know that's probably not a whole what your fans want to hear, but certainly when they come to Oregon, and I would encourage them to do so. They can visit us at the winery in our tasting room also. And I think that's quite a bit of what we have up here. Willamette Valley's, they're pretty good size. I mean, they're one of the bigger guys in Oregon, but they're still small compared to wineries in California. And with that said, I think a lot of the recent focus is on small wineries like myself, you know, 2,500 to 3,000 cases.
Uh-huh.
We try and sell most of our stuff right out the front door. That way it's a lot easier to keep a handle on it, and we're not making UPS rich in the process.
Yeah, for sure. I noticed that I'm looking at your website here, and I noticed your wines. You have, most of these vintages are, you know, old. Is this up to date?
Yeah, no, it's not up to date.
Okay.
I'm pretty much a one-man show. My friends that helped me would throw rocks at me for saying that, but we get a lot of people. My sons come in and help, and my neighbor's been helping me, God bless them, for about almost 20 years. And some things just, they get out of control. We don't sell a lot of wine off of our website. I mean, we do get the occasional people that call or write and want to do stuff over email. But it's just there's not enough hours in the day to keep me, you know, at that. And I'd rather be out in the vineyard or in the winery than on the computer, sadly to say. I mean, that's kind of why I got in this business and way back when, because I'm not much of an office worker. Over the years, we have really expanded our focus of wines. So, you know, as I mentioned, we started with Merlot. And we were quick to add, found a really nice Cab vineyard, and I've got Syrah and Barbera and Zinfandel and two different Pinot Noirs. So one off my vineyard and one from Temperance Hill Vineyard.
Oh, so, how many acres do you have of each of these vines?
You know, we buy the acre, and we try and produce about 350 to 400 cases of each one. So we're not real long on anything. So yes, the answer to your question before was yes, the vintages on the website are way out of date. I encourage people to stop in to see what's new. That's, I don't know if that applies. It's a long, kind of a long commute from Florida.
Oh yeah, rather, yeah.
But when people are out visiting, they'd love to stop by, and we get a lot of people that come through the door, and their first comment is, "Oh, thank God, something besides Pinot Noir." And I say that tongue in cheek, but you know, we are pretty Pinot centric here in Oregon. But that was my idea, was to find microclimates, and there certainly are quite a few of them here. That we could grow other grapes and therefore offer people something different. And again, I only do reds. So I was just talking to a friend of mine that just got back from vacation. We kind of caught up with each other in the airport in San Francisco. He was coming from one place and I was coming from another. And talking about how when we first got in this business, people told us that, oh, you know, you'll be able to take a couple of months off there in the wintertime and go someplace warm.
Yeah, I'm right.
Lucky. I'm lucky if I get about a week and a half or two to do that. Just, yeah. There's so much to do. And there's so many things that you want to follow up on, you know, as well as keeping a good eye on the wines.
You have a vineyard.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
How big? How many acres?
The whole property's 10 acres.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Yeah. So that's pretty small by, you know, but most of the vineyards here in Oregon are pretty small. Just in the last 10 years or so have there been a lot more plantings of 20 acres on up, you know. There are a lot of, like I said, microclimates, and that's what, you know, you plant the right grape on the right slope with the right soil and the right sun exposure, and then treat it correctly, and you might have something there. And there's all those variables are what come into play when you're dealing with all these different vineyards.
Right. Yeah. Well, I find that all around the country. You've talked to wineries everywhere, and most of them are small vineyards. Most people have just a small acreage planted. More so than anywhere else. Yeah.
Yeah, we're the only nuts people that are crazy enough to do that, you know. Big farmers in California. One of my sons works for a vineyard that's about 1,000 acres.
Yeah.
And they, you know, it's like working for a big corporation. Everything is the same each year. You know, there's not much changes. And, you know, I think half the fun of it is being able to respond to the marketplace or follow your whims. And I see a lot of that in Oregon and newer wine growing regions, you know, and there are no rules. And I kind of like that, you know, it makes for a lot of interesting wines.
Do you oak every one of your wines?
Yeah, we do. So everything's red and it's all in barrels. And I use a lot of different oaks.
Do you?
And some wines, I leave in for a lot longer than others. So Cab and Merlot are typically 24 months in oak. Uh-huh. And, I think people drink. I'm kind of old school. I've been doing this for making wine professionally for over 30 years.
Wow.
And I think, especially today, I mean, I've run into a lot of those young winemakers that they're very enthusiastic, but they don't have a lot of depth of experience, and they don't taste wines that are old or
right.
keep a cellar, or they don't have that history there. They'll get it, but it takes time. And I personally, I was having a bottle of my 06 Pinot Noir at dinner the other night, and it was just lovely. I tend to let wine sit for a couple years in my cellar, my personal cellar, before I'm drinking them. And a lot of wines just need time to come together, you know, or to be at their peak, let's say.
So especially your reds,
it really rewards patience.
Yes.
So, but we do a lot of different oaks, all basically 60-gallon barrels.
Oh. Where are you getting your oak then? Use different which ones? Where?
I use mostly French oak, with the exception of Zinfandel and Cabernet can both stand some American oak.
Oh.
If American oak's a little doesn't have quite the finesse that French oak does. French oak meshes really a lot better with subtle wines, especially wines that are more elegant, like Pinot Noir.
Right.
Big wines, you know, I even use a little American oak on my Syrah, Cab, Merlot. And Zinfandel can handle a little American oak because they've got a lot tougher tannin profile than Pinot Noir does. So,
Barbera is a little bit lighter too. So,
my Barbera is a tough one. It's a big one up here.
Is it really?
Yeah, I grew up down in the Bay Area, San Francisco area.
I lived there for many years. Yeah,
right there, Napa and Sonoma. And there's only a few places that Barbera does real well down there, mostly mountainous areas in between Sonoma and Napa and old school plantings like Louis Martini and that.
Right.
And you didn't really see it, you know. Those old Italian varieties were planted, but they weren't real popular.
Yeah.
Up here, I'm going to plug a neighbor of mine. We call him Chateau Bob at Cascade Cliffs.
Mm-hmm.
And he's done an outstanding job with Barbera, and it took me a few years, but I finally talked a neighbor of his out of some fruit, and it's easily one of our most popular cellars. Barbera has high acidity, about twice the level of most reds when it starts out, and when you finish it and it's ready to drink. It maintains that acidity, and winemakers always love acid, you know.
Yes.
I mean,
It
alludes to how long something's going to last. You know, the longer, the more acid it has, the longer time it'll hang out. I mean, you even see that in good Rieslings and Sauvignon Blancs, and the more comfortable it is on the palate. But Barbera here, at least where I'm getting it, is it's pretty big, and it's almost as inky as my Syrah.
Wow.
So that, you know, as it gets a little older, 3 or 4 years in the bottle, you know, it's just gorgeous. It gets a creamy texture to it, and the tannins relax a little bit, and it really becomes a popular drinker.
I am drooling. I love a Barbera. I fell in love with a Barbera when I was in California many years ago. And I used to get one down in Paso Robles. Paso Robles used to, a couple of wineries there make some very nice Barberas. And then Napa Valley made a couple. But they seem to have disappeared. I'm glad to hear that they are making them in Oregon because it's a beautiful wine, a beautiful grape and a beautiful wine. I always enjoyed the Barbera.
Yeah, well, you caught me. I was going to say most everything I make is from Oregon, and it's unusual to grow big reds here, though Southern Oregon is doing a great job.
Yeah.
But that Barbera is the lone grape that I get from our northern cousins. It's up on the Columbia Gorge, which is the dividing line between Oregon and California. It's the border. It's pretty spectacular, the gorge is, and I never get tired of going up there. But there's a big volcanic uplift along the river, and there's the terrace that the Barbera is on is about it's a big bench about 1,000 feet above the river.
Wow!
And in the summertime, boy, it just gets nice and warm, and the soil is really deep and very well drained. And it's just a perfect spot for Barbera. And, you know, one of the interesting things I find about the wine business is you go around and you taste, you know, somebody may have gotten cuttings from us or from California on a different variety, and they plant it in Montana or somewhere, and the growing season is so different and the soils are so different that it makes a completely different wine.
Oh, without a doubt.
Like, I love Zinfandel, being from California, and the Zinfandel I grow, I've been battling it. It's my problem child. everyone here loves it because it tastes like fresh raspberries, but I have that California notion of what it should be, and I'm always telling them, no, I'll get it. It's always a challenge, but it's very interesting. I think when you travel a bit, And you ask for local wines, and I hope that's what people do. You know, that really sets it apart and gives you a more of a feel for what can be done in an area. I think it's kind of certainly we've had a great success in Oregon with Pinot Noir, but there are plenty of other varieties that will grow here, and it's a little short-sighted to do just one. You know, it's excellent to try and perfect what you're doing, but to basically have all your eggs in one basket, kind of a tough sell.
But, you know, there's so much that can be done with a Pinot Noir, and it's just such a beautiful result from playing with it. People absolutely love it. I don't mean
to say that some of my neighbors don't do it really well by having 10 Pinot Noirs, but after you taste wines for a little bit, you're in one place, and a lot of people have, especially new wine drinkers, have a little
sweet
problem
tooth.
Telling the difference. Yeah, or they have a sweet tooth. Yeah,
sweet tooth. Yeah. And Pinot does not give you a sweet. So, yes.
No.
That's the problem with the Pinot and the fact that it doesn't present itself in any sweet. And people, new wine drinkers do have a sweet tooth when it comes to wine. They don't want that heavy red. And so you're doing something light. I mean, you're getting your Zinfandel and bringing out those light, fruity flavors and that raspberry and stuff is probably good because people are probably intrigued by that as opposed to the heavy walk across the room red.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting to see, and speaking of the experience thing, when I first opened our tasting room about 8 or 9 years ago, we got a lot of people that just wandered in, and they were here to visit Aunt Polly and Uncle Fred, and they needed to get out of the house. And, you know, in the last couple of years, I've been very pleasantly surprised, and I think it says a lot about Oregon wines in general, that people are coming here instead of Napa and Sonoma.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a place new. Everybody's very friendly, and things are different, if not a bit wild at times. And there, it doesn't have the notoriety of Napa Valley, but it doesn't have the prices either. And there are a lot of, you know, developments with the wine industry. There's great food and entertainment. And, you know, when you get in on the ground floor, you can be really surprised and get some great values.
I tell people you have to visit Napa once, but once you do, you visited it, visit other places. You know, you don't need to keep going back. There's a lot to offer. You mentioned something there that caught me off guard. You said you opened up your tasting room 8 years ago, but you've been in business for 20 years.
Right.
Oh, right. The math doesn't work. What were you doing for 12 years?
Well, I was making wine in an old barn at my house, basically, and going out on the road and selling it. And then my neighbor had been trying to get my attention, and he kept telling me about this property he had, and it would make a great place for a winery. And I kept saying, you know, I'm too busy. I can't do that. And finally, a couple of years later, we went out there. He had to check something in the pump house on a freezing day, you know. And I was like, boy, this would be a great place for a winery. And he about kicked me. So we made a deal, and I ended up buying the property from him, and we built a winery, actually built a full-size facility in 2008. But until then, we made the wines here in a barn at my house, on my property at my house. So, you know, as I was saying, there's always a lot to do, and I'm in the tasting room once in a while. I actually do like to chat with people, but I don't want to do it every day.
Right.
And we're still small enough where we're basically open in the spring through Thanksgiving and just weekends. So, you know, it's not something you have to do every day, and we don't make that much wine. So it moves real well in the tasting room, but it also moves well outside. Though I don't have a distributor in Florida yet.
No.
It's a long way to send some wine.
Yes, it is. But I'd love to try your Barbera, though. I'll tell you what, you got my curiosity up there.
Well, you'll have to come out and give us a try.
I will have to do that now.
You're neck of the woods. I'll bring you a bottle.
There you go. That would be even better. Take that week and a half you have free and come down here.
That sounds like a plan. Do a little good fishing down there, though we have pretty good fishing up here, too.
Oh, yeah. But since you're northern area there, a little bit more so than north of Salem, when do you get bud break?
You know, it's real interesting. The farm that I have, or the vineyard that I have, we had cherries on it, and it had prunes on it before that.
Oh.
And the cherries, one of the reasons my neighbor suggested it was the cherries got ripe about 2 weeks before everybody else. And we have we're at about 300-foot elevation, so we don't get the fog on the valley floor, and we don't get, you know, the cold air drains off of the mountain there. But we're not near as high as the surrounding hills. So the hill I'm on, as I said, we're at 300 feet, goes up to about 1,000 feet. So
wow.
I would say it's hard to say, and I don't want to jinx us, but, you know, we don't get bud break until late here, especially compared to Sonoma. Yeah, we pack a lot into a short season here. It's real interesting to me that most of my grapes are not from this area. They're from east of Mount Hood. So they're more of a Walla Walla climate. They're along the river, a lot less rain and a lot more sunshine. But strangely enough, they're longer season varieties, but they get bud break after we do, by about 2 to 3 weeks.
Wow.
And then they're so hot all summer long, they catch up and pass us way before Verizon, when the grapes actually start turning color.
All right.
And it's a really interesting situation.
But then
it really depends. I think, you know, we were talking about it just the other day. I think we're already noticing buds are beginning to swell this year. And normally, you know, we say probably April 1st to April 15th in Sonoma, and we're a good month later than they are.
Wow.
Yeah.
The grapes that you're growing then, they need the season. They need a little bit more time to properly mature. How
right.
are you getting them to mature if you have, I mean, basically a shorter season?
Well, it's a shorter season, but it's warmer than here in the valley, and by quite a bit. There's a lot less rainfall. So I remember when I first moved up here in 1990 from Sonoma, I consulted the Farmer's Almanac like any wannabe farmer would. And I was thinking, what am I doing? You know, I know I'm going to a little more fun and wild area as far as wine goes, where the rules are less set in stone. But what about the weather? And we both areas get about the same amount of rain, 35 to 37 inches.
Huh.
I think what the stats were in Sonoma was there are 260 to 270 clear days a year.
Right.
And in Salem, it's directly the opposite. There are 270 to 280 rainy days a year.
Oh, no.
I'm sitting in front of a sunlight as we speak. No. So, you know, when you go east, I hope I'm not confusing you, but as you go progress from the valley here in Salem up along the Columbia River and the Gorge, once you hit east of the Cascades, which Mount Hood is in the Cascades,
right,
Oregon becomes, and eastern Oregon and eastern Washington are desert.
Yeah.
So they're irrigated. And so the Dalles area where most of my fruit comes, these longer season varieties, they get about 7 inches or 8 inches of rain a year, which
That's
is a lot
it?
Different than our 35.
Wow.
So it's a very different climate, and they are able to ripen in a short span these longer season varieties because they have so much heat.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, it makes sense.
Yeah, it does. Well, you know, you have to kind of forget everything you know when I moved up here from California. I had to kind of keep it in the back of my mind and not pay such strict attention to the rules, because there are exceptions.
A major ones, it sounds like, in that area there.
Yeah, you betcha. You betcha.
Yeah. So what bricks do you usually get on your on the grapes there, at yours and then the ones over in the desert?
Well, the you know, we pick by flavor and ripeness, but, you know, I'm not trying to say we get low sugars, but, you know, even this year, my Barbera came in at 25 bricks.
Wow.
Zinfandel's a little bit different. You know, we had a shorter season in 2011 than we would have hoped for. Though the grapes here in the valley, we had, you know, we were picking in November, so technically we had an even longer season.
Mm-hmm.
But it just took that long because there wasn't that much heat accumulated over the year. So, to answer your question, ripeness to me, anything over, you know, 23.5 to 25.5.
That's
for
good.
Those varieties. Yeah. Yeah.
That's good. I mean, you know, if you can get that.
Well, what's really unique, and I know I've never met in my 30 years in this business, I've never met a grower that didn't actually grow the best grapes in the world, right?
Right.
But, what's very unique to me is that in Healdsburg, in Sonoma County, there's definitely a lot longer growing season, but the days stay warm. So we lose that vitality and that freshness of acid in the summertime.
Right.
Because it stays warm all night long.
No.
Whereas here, when it gets to 100 degrees, and it does, doesn't get very very often, but it does, it cools off to 55 at night or 50 in the vineyard easily, and it just retains it. You know, it's like putting the fruit in the refrigerator.
Wow, 50-degree difference, wow.
Yeah, it makes it maintains that freshness of the fruit, and I think you see that in our Pinot Noirs especially. I mean, They do some nice Pinot Noirs in California, but I think ours are up front fresher, and they maintain that youthful vivaciousness over a longer period than Californians, California Pinots do.
Do you get influence from the ocean?
Oh yeah. I caught the tail end of Don talking to you, and as I said, I'm from Sonoma County, and it's basically the same layout here. There is a low range of coastal hills in between hills and mountains here, both here and in Sonoma.
Right.
So, and we're about 45 minutes, or if you get stuck behind a tractor, it might be an hour to the coast, and that's basically the same as in Sonoma County.
Right, it is.
You know, the coastal influence. It's not as near the coast as Paso or the central coast of California, but, you know, we get a very big cooling influence from the ocean.
Right. Well,
and
you have that.
One of the benefits of my vineyard, actually, is that every evening in the summertime, we get these breezes off the coast that at about 4:30 or 5 o'clock. To cool things down. Excuse me.
Sure. You have that an opening, like a valley that runs from the ocean that feeds right into the Willamette Valley. So it
you
does
bet.
Keep it cool then. Yeah, okay.
Right. Now, a little bit more for your geography lesson is the Columbia Gorge, again, where most of my longer season varieties come from. That's the only opening in the Cascades from north of Washington all the way down to southern Oregon. So the wind really goes through there. That's the only channel. And, the wintertime, it depends which way it's going. If it's going east to west or west to east, you know, whether you get the moisture off the coast or the chill from the mountains.
Oh, okay.
Can really make a big difference, you know?
Yeah,
if there's a bunch of holes, it goes everywhere, and it's not so important if one's plugged up or not. But here, you know, we get most of the wet weather we get. You know, it's like a little bit like very North California.
Because whenever I see weather reports or anything down here in Florida, I see it hitting Oregon. It's always coming off the ocean there, always coming off the Pacific and just pounding right into you.
It does quite a bit. It's a very similar weather pattern all the way through Seattle to Vancouver, B.C. So we get a lot of the same systems. And actually, you know, they'll start out a day or two earlier in Northern California. So we're like Eureka, maybe not as far south as Sonoma.
Oh, well, so that does influence the grapes quite a bit then with that. More so than what you would think about. Wow.
Now, there is a banana belt in Oregon down around Ashland and Grants Pass where they're growing very successfully Zinfandel and Cabernet and Syrah on their own, and they're isolated. There really isn't a hole in the hills, if you will, or a path for the ocean to come in. So it gets very warm down there and a lot earlier than we get.
We talked to some wineries down in that area there, and I was shocked about the difference of weather there because they were comparing their weather to yours up there and around Salem, and it's just like unbelievable the difference that you're getting down there. It's like you said, there's no gap, no opening there to let that weather influence it that much, and they just set in their own little hole there.
Right. That's exactly it. They don't have any cooling influence, so it's, you know, you can swim in the river down there a lot earlier than I would even try up here.
You probably couldn't get through the ice.
Exactly.
The state government, the Oregon government, how are they toward wineries? I mean, there's so many wineries in Oregon. How do they treat you?
Don't get me started on government.
Well, good, bad, indifferent. You want to kill them? You want to hug them? What is your?
You know, they're fresh. They're a group of fresh faces, and they're. I know people have had problems with them, generally they're pretty good folks. They're trying to understand the way we do it. You know, I think at the first, at the inception of their rulemaking, they looked to neighboring states, California and Washington, and they wanted to do things a little bit differently because they didn't have the bigness that Washington and California do. And they've been slow to change on provincial on some things, but for the most part, they're very understanding. And I was actually on one of the, I don't know what you called it, a steering committee or a consulting.
Oh, yeah.
As a member of the industry, and I got nothing but great things to say about the people I worked with. They've been very good folks. And there, you know, there's in addition to the wine business here, as I said, there's a lot of culinary happenings. You know, there's a lot of different foods here to work with as far as berries and fish and that. But there's also a burgeoning industry that was here before the wineries, basically. Thank God, the breweries, small breweries. And now there's a renaissance going on with small distilleries.
Oh, really?
So all of those people have to deal with the Liquor Control Board. And I think they're, you know, I've seen new things on their websites. And they're doing a great job. I mean, I'm not married to anybody there, but they seem to do a very good job.
Well, good, good. It's something I just read too, and I know vintage vineyard. Does Oregon require 100% vintage, or is it 85 or 75 or what? I've read.
No, that's a good question. I should know it, and I feel ashamed that I don't. But I do all my wines are 100% vintage.
Okay.
So
I've been reading stuff lately.
I think they made an exception for, and not by vintage, for blending, because Cab and Merlot and that are very different than Pinot Noir. They've allowed other things to be blended in there and still, call it a varietal.
Yeah, 75% is required around the country, but I understand Oregon is go by stricter standards on everything. They're like 85% on... on varietal and the vintage, I think, is 100%. Stuff I've been reading about it, and I think Oregon is stricter on their standards.
Yeah, you know, it's a double-edged sword. I understood what the guys were that originally came here, the founders, David Ladd and, you know, David Adelsheim and Bob McRitchie and all those guys, they wanted to set a high standard, and that did it, but it doesn't give much flexibility. As I said, it's a double-edged sword, and you can't please everybody all the time. So, but the wines, the wines are definitely show vintage differences. But we're getting a lot better understanding as time goes on, how to work with the different classifications of vintages, you know, whether it's a cool vintage or a warm vintage, and, you know, to be basic about it,
right.
How to treat them differently and come up with more consistency in the wines.
There you go.
Allow for vintage deviation.
Yeah, I was wondering simply because I've been reading stuff about it lately, and I knew Oregon had different standards. I just didn't know exactly what they work, what the line was, what they've been working with. So,
Well, it started out as a lot, as you said, a lot higher percentage of a varietal to make it pure. You know, whereas California, I think back in the old days, first certainly when I got started, it was 51%.
Really, 51?
Yeah. It left a lot of room.
It sure did. I don't remember that. Wow. They're up to 75 now. I mean, like I tell people, most places do 100% and they don't worry about it, you know, but, you know, it's funny, 51%.
Yeah. Well, rules, though, you know, we're a bunch of renegades up here anyway, and I just tell people, you know, they always come in and they're so intimidated by wine. And I just said, you know, I can tell you all day why this is the best wine in the valley. But if you don't like it, it's not good. And that's the bottom line. Try wines that you like. And if it takes, you know, there's certainly a learning curve as to, and a palate curve as to what you get comfortable with and what you start out drinking and find yourself drinking 10 years later. They're very different.
Oh, always. I tell people there are two types of wines in the world, the type you like and the type you don't like.
There you go.
And that's what you need to remember right there. Yeah.
It's pretty simple.
Mike, do you have anything that you like to ask Rick here while we've got him on?
No, I'm good. He covered quite a bit there. Very interesting. Really appreciate the discussion on that.
I'm going to let you tell us all about Mystic Winery and how to get a hold of you and where you are and your Facebook page, and people can cry because they can't order from you, but you can tell them where you are so when they're there, they can come and get it.
That's it. Come visit Oregon and see all the wineries, not just us. But we are technically, the winery is in Amity. The business address is 3995 Deepwood, like deep in the woods. Deepwood Lane, Northwest, and that's in Salem, Oregon. The zip is 97304. You can find us on the web at www.mysticwine.com, and that's Mystic Wine singular, not plural. And, you know, I have hard enough time with my cell phone. I don't do Facebook. Though I am looking for somebody to come and do that for us. That's one more computer task I really don't want to learn. As I said, our tasting room, generally starting in March, is open Friday, Saturday, and Sunday from noon to 5. And we're kind of right smack dab in the middle of things. There's probably 40 wineries within half an hour of us.
Wow.
So there gives you a lot to do. You know, they say if you're going to drink all day, you got to start in the morning. So.
Yeah, you never make it to the afternoon. Yeah,
that's it.
So one more question for you.
And, you know, you can send me an email, I guess, at rick@mysticwine.com, and I might even answer.
Maybe.
So, yeah, definitely, it's easier to come out and see us. I know that I'm pretty demanding, but you know, as we get a little bit bigger, maybe we'll get a little bit more available too.
I have one more question for you. You mentioned Cascade Cliffs.
Yep.
As your buddy. If I get a hold of him, you think he'd be willing to come on next week and join us?
Oh, yeah. Bob's totally a showman. He's a nut. And he makes nice wines. So, yeah, you should get in touch with him.
I will do that. I'll look up his number and I'll call him. If you get a chance to talk with him, tell him you look forward to the call and like to get him on next week.
I'll do it.
Great. Fantastic. Wow. Well, thank you, Rick, for your time. Really appreciate it.
Not a problem. Thanks, you guys.
Yeah,
very interesting.
Good luck to you.
Thank you.
All right. Bye.
Thank
you. Bye-bye.
Wow, very cool.
That was fun.
All right.
Two good guests tonight. Boy, I tell you, it was fun.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, very good. So, yeah, we're definitely going to be on Oregon next week. And I looked up Cascade Cliffs' website and just, you know, took a look around a little bit while y'all were talking. And, yeah, very nice. Very good deal. So we'll look forward to that as well. And possibly another guest that was not able to make it tonight. So that would be another one.
Yeah, I think that one that's going to make tonight is going to be the 23rd. So
that's right, the 23rd. Never mind.
Yeah, I'll see if I can get a hold of Bob at Cascade Cliffs for next week. That would...
That could be an hour right there.
It almost could be, yeah. Barbera, I love Barbera wines. I fell in love with those years ago, and those guys are making Barberas. We need to make a trip out to Oregon so I can get some Barberas.
Okay. I'm there.
Are you? Okay.
Yeah. Well, you have a wine fest this coming on the 11th on Saturday. 11 a.m. to 4 p.m., and I think we should let people know about it using our ad that we have. So
okay, we've only got a minute 46 left on time. Oh, 90
okay.
seconds.
We'll do that real quick. In a minute and 15, we'll be right back.
Coming up this Saturday at Florida Estates Winery, it's Wine Fest, 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. Enjoy live music, have a little fun, and shop our vendors providing unique handmade items and some brand names you have known for years. Participate in an informative wine tasting with wine expert and show host, Ron. Sample some of Florida Estates Winery's world-class wines. Shopping is always fun, and Wine Fest is a great way to pick up unique gift items. Come out to Florida Estates Winery and enjoy the weekend with us. Listen to live music and shop under the giant oak trees while enjoying a glass of your favorite wine. This is a family event, and pets are welcome at Florida Estates Winery. See you there. Florida Estates Winery is located at 25241 State Road 52 in Land O'Lakes, Florida. Call 813-996-2113 or email corp@flune.com. That's C-O-R-P at F-L-E-W-N.com for more information. Florida Estates Winery is open daily, 11 a.m. to 6 p.m.
All right. Have a few seconds possibly. I don't know if this goes into overtime or what after
I don't know. I think she might cut us off. So if she we got 10 seconds. So
I haven't heard anything. Join us next week and follow us on what happened? Are we still on?
Yeah, we're still on for a few more seconds.
We're in overtime.
We're in overtime. No, it did click into overtime. I just saw it here. So we're recording. Wow.
Okay. Join us next week. We will continue next Thursday on February 16th at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time with Oregon, and hopefully we'll have Cascade Clips on. And follow us on – like us on Facebook. Go to facebook.com/allaboutwinebtr, and it's also easy to remember the Twitter. Now we're on Twitter, so follow us on Twitter. That's twitter.com/allaboutwinebtr. And I've been updating it quite a bit during the show tonight. So I did put a couple of tweets out there. So, do that. And, it's real easy. I can do that from the studio page. I'm sure you see that on the right-hand side. But
I do, yeah. I see it there.
I type in what I want and click send, and it automatically updates the Twitter. So same address kind of as Facebook is on Twitter. Just go to twitter.com or facebook.com. Both of those /allaboutwinebtr, all one word. You can also email the show. allaboutwine101@gmail.com, allaboutwine101@gmail.com. Ron gets those, and you know if it's something we can put on the air, we'll definitely work on that and get that. If you have any questions, any comments, you know, we'd love to hear from you. Do that. Let us know you're listening, and we have a lot of archive listeners and. Let us know what you want to hear on about wine. And if you follow us on Twitter, I will follow you back. So,
yeah, that's right. That's
within
right.
reason, I've had a few requests. Yeah, I've had some funny ones on my other accounts, and I'm just I don't follow them. There's a bunch of wine people on Twitter, and so I've been locating them, and you know I'm following about 29 now. And
that's cool.
You know, yeah. So hopefully within time, you know, I think it only went up like a week ago, so not too bad. But
not too bad. That's more than you have one.
Yes. Well, no, there's only 5 following us. There's I'm following 29 people.
I see. Okay.
Yeah, that's okay. They'll be there. It's easy to put keywords in there, and people find you by keywords. So I get on Twitter quite a bit. I don't know how many accounts, but anyway. but I bet you Rick from Mystic Wines is not on Twitter.
I bet you he is not.
That is one more thing that
that he's not going to do.
That is pretty funny. I heard that. Yeah. And he has Facebook listed on his website, so I was expecting, you know, facebook.com/, you know, and then the address, and then he says, no, that's just one more thing.
Yeah. It's probably there, and the last update was when he opened it.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. We're on Facebook. Thank you. I don't know how, but
I don't know. Yeah.
That was good. Good talk with him. And also Don. Yeah, definitely good there. So I'm glad they're
very knowledgeable young man. Yeah.
Yeah. Glad they both made it on there, and very cool. Let's see. Gave out the I think the address was in the
add, but just in case, go to Florida State's Winery. Open 11 a.m. until 6 p.m. every day except major holidays. That is located at 25241 State Road 52 in Land O'Lakes, Florida. Visit the website for more details, information about the wines and everything, upcoming events, and to subscribe to the newsletter at www.floridaestateswines.com. That is plural, floridaestateswines.com. Or you can call area code 813-996-2113. So 996-2113. And Wine Fest this weekend. Definitely check it out, 11 a.m. until 4 p.m. there at Florida State's Winery on State Road 52, 4 miles west of Interstate 75 on State Road 52. So visit, and it's going to be a great, great Saturday, and then Sunday everything's going to be cold. So
yeah. It's going to get nasty because the State Fair is happening. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
Never fails.
Yep.
Yeah. Never
can look
fails.
Ahead and say, you know what? I bet next year it's going to do the same thing.
It will.
Be rainy about. Yeah, it's going to be.
Always does. It either gets cold or rainy or something always happens during the State Fair.
Mm-hmm.
We should know better than to schedule anything during State Fair week. You know what I mean?
That's right. Yeah. Well, you got to do it, though. So.
Yeah, we do. Yeah, we do. So.
Yeah. All right. We will see you all next week right here on Blog Talk Radio /All About Wine. Be sure to visit the show page and don't forget to follow us and like us on Twitter and Facebook. And thank you all for listening.
Thank you for
next
listening.
Week. 7 p.m. February 16th. We'll continue with Oregon. Thank you again, and have a great rest of the week. And
yeah, good night, everyone.
Closing the show. Thank you. Woo!
Yeah.